and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, August 21st, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Mason City activists organizing Make It Stop event for Central Park. On August 28th, 1955, Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old from Chicago, was lynched near Money, Mississippi, after being falsely accused of offending a white woman in her family's grocery store. What happened to Till was so severe that his face was unrecognizable after his body was discovered in the Tallahatchie River 3 days after his murder. Less than a month later, an all-white jury found Till's killers not guilty. By December of the same year, one state over, the Montgomery bus boycotts began and eventually led to Alabama's busing segregation laws being affirmed as unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Though not directly related, historians link the two as being part of the same mid-1950s civil rights movement push. The tragedy of Till's murder helped to galvanize impactful change and hopeful progress. Next Friday, August 28th, a local activism group is organizing an event in Mason City to recognize past tragedies such as Till's murder while also spotlighting the need for restoration. It's not enough to fight against Black death. We also need to uplift Black people and support their happiness and healing, Mason City Coalition for Justice and Equality organizer Tamira Little said. For Little, such an event is particularly important because, as she said, it's difficult and emotional being a Black person right now. She said that the March to Make It Stop in Mason City's Central Park is an opportunity for people to have a place where they can laugh after so many tears and so much blood has been shed. In that way, the March to Make It Stop is not unlike the Juneteenth event that Little, Brandon McGriff, and other local organizers put together earlier this summer. In some ways, it's building off of the success of that. I definitely feel like we're growing as a community. We've come closer, McGriff said. Something that I think is so nice hearing people say, I've never felt this close to people I didn't know before. I heard a lot of that at our Juneteenth event. So things are definitely changing. The way that McGriff sees it, the first step of feeling a closeness is crucial to bettering a community. It's easier to fight for your community once you truly get to know your community, he said. Little agreed that there have already been positive advancements locally in the past few months, but that more does need to happen, even if larger and more lasting change takes time. I do one day want to see a more diverse Mason City. Absolutely. But that is going to take a lot of grassroots work over several years. That's something that could be decades in the making, she said. For the event, the organizers are meeting in Central Park before marching. When that concludes, the plan is to have a celebration of sorts with Black musicians, comedians, and poets from the area. It is a little more difficult to find Black musicians, although I have been given quite a few people who are at least part of bands that we are trying to work with, Little said. And organizers don't intend for this to just be some sort of one-off. They want future remembrances and celebrations in this vein. They hope that such events can spur more Black artists, Black-owned businesses, and even mutual aid groups. As McGriff noted, it's easier to fight for your community once you truly get to know your community. Cerro Gordo COVID-19 update. Flu vaccines more vital than ever. A data snapshot for Friday, August 21st. 54,709 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 692 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 511 total recovered in Cerro Gordo. 181 total active cases in Cerro Gordo. 1,017 deaths in Iowa. 20 deaths in Cerro Gordo. 14,211 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. Flu vaccine, more important than ever. The combination of COVID-19 and seasonal influenza has the potential to overwhelm our hospitals and cripple our medical resources. It is more important than ever to make sure to get vaccinated against this year's seasonal flu virus to prevent flu-related illness and diminish the strain on our healthcare system. The recently released Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report contains the recommendations that doctors, nurses, and pharmacists will follow for the 2020-2021 flu season. To view this report, visit cdc.gov. Iowa ignores White House Task Force advice on virus response. A White House coronavirus task force has issued new recommendations for Iowa to mandate face masks and to close bars in the state's largest cities to try to slow the spread of COVID-19. So far, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds hasn't acted on those recommendations. The new recommendations were included in an August 9th report from the task force headed by Dr. Deborah Burks, the Des Moines Register reported. Burks discussed those recommendations last week in a meeting with Iowa State Epidemiologist Dr. Caitlin Padotti. Burks suggested Iowa consider measures other states have taken, including bar restrictions and mandating face masks in public, Padotti said. The report said masks should be required, bars should be closed, gyms should be closed or limited to 25% of capacity, and social gatherings should be limited to 25 or fewer people in 17 metro areas and 48 counties. Those areas include the Des Moines metropolitan area, Council Bluffs, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Dubuque, Iowa City, Ames, and the Quad Cities. Reynolds has rejected numerous calls for a mask requirement, including from physicians groups and those treating COVID-19 patients at Des Moines intensive care units. Reynolds' office did not respond Thursday to the Register's request for comment on the new task force recommendations. Overnight burglary attempt in Mason City leads to arrest. Two people are facing charges after police say they were caught inside a storage unit which didn't belong to them early Friday morning. Around 12:15 a.m., the Mason City Police Department responded to a call that two suspects were seen on a security camera walking around, possibly breaking into units at A1 Security Self Storage, located at 4067 South Federal Avenue, according to a press release. Upon arriving at the scene, officers opened the door of a unit which was missing a padlock, where they discovered Shelley Ann Hitchcock, 40, of Rockwell, and Thomas Bernard Hitchcock, 48, of Mason City. The suspects were arrested and both charged with felony third-degree burglary. Thomas Hitchcock also faces charges of possession of burglary tools and violation of a no-contact order. Shelley Hitchcock was also found to have an outstanding warrant for her arrest and faces seemingly unrelated drug charges as well. The pair is being held in the Cerro Gordo County Jail on bail of over $6,000 apiece. Mason City Police are still investigating the incident and ask anyone with knowledge of the crime to contact them at 641-421-3600 or call Crime Stoppers at 800-383-0088. United Way of North Central Iowa to hold food drive. The United Way of North Central Iowa will host a food drive on Thursday, September 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. The food drive will take place at United Way of North Central Iowa in Mason City. United Way of North Central Iowa will be accepting non-perishable items, a press release said. Preferred items include protein, such as peanut butter, canned meat or fish, canned fruits and vegetables, canned soup, pasta sauce, breakfast items including cereal, 100% fruit juice, and personal care items and paper products such as soap, deodorant, and toothpaste. United Way will additionally accept cash and check donations. All donations will be used to serve the 8 counties served by United Way North Central Iowa. According to the press release from United Way, 15.94% of children in the region suffer from food insecurity. Iowa jobless claims below 84,000. Initial claims for unemployment benefits in Iowa rose slightly last week, but overall, the number of Iowans requesting jobless assistance remained below 84,000. Iowa workforce development officials on Thursday reported initial claims filed between Sunday, August 9th, and Saturday, August 15th, totaled 6,544. That included 5,828 filed by individuals who work and live in Iowa and 716 claims sought by non-residents. The number of continuing weekly unemployment claims was 83,610, a decrease of 8,490 from the previous week. Initial claims reported on August 13th were 5,282, and continuing claims were 92,853. The U.S. Department of Labor adjusted last week's initial claim number in Iowa down to 4,891, a decrease of 391, and lowered the total of continuing claims to 92,100, a decrease of 753, for a total decline of 1,144, according to Iowa Workforce Development. Officials with the state agency said they rely on the weekly data released by the U.S. Labor Department to report their numbers, and they also adopt the federal revisions to the previously published data. Unemployment insurance benefit payments to jobless Iowans totaled $23,465,906 last week. Industries with the most claims were manufacturing with 1,664, followed by a grouping of self-employed independent contractors and others at 887. After that, healthcare and social assistance industries totaled 608, construction 449, and accommodation and food services establishments with 429 initial claims last week. A total of $7,881,600 in federal pandemic unemployment compensation benefits was paid during the week of August 9th through the 15th, which were retroactive payments as the program ended July 25th. Since April 4th, a total of $1,580,831,143 in FPUC benefits has been paid, according to Iowa Workforce Development officials. Also, a total of $4,412,626 was paid in pandemic unemployment assistance benefits during the past week, and $3,912,116.39 in separate pandemic emergency unemployment compensation were paid. Since May 27th, a total of $47,359,563 in PEUC benefits have been paid, Iowa Workforce Development officials reported. On August 14th, the Federal Emergency Management Agency approved Iowa's application to participate in the Lost Wages Assistance Program. Iowans whose unemployment is the result of the pandemic and who are eligible for at least $100 in benefits each week will qualify for an additional $300 in weekly benefits proactive to the week ending August 1st. State officials say the federal agencies continue to issue guidance, and Iowa Workforce Development will continue developing the implementation process required for this program and update its website as additional information becomes available. Since the announcement of the program approval, Iowa Workforce Development has seen an increase in initial and continuing claims as awareness of the benefits became more widely known. Officials anticipate this will be reflected in increased claim numbers next week. Individuals who have exhausted the additional 13 weeks of PEUC benefits may be eligible for state extended benefits announced in June. Claimants should continue to file weekly claims so that their claims can be reviewed to determine eligibility for state benefits. Those benefits may provide eligible claimants up to an additional 13 weeks of unemployment benefits, officials said. However, not everyone who qualified for PEUC will be eligible for state extended benefits. Information is available online. Iowa Workforce Development previously had waived the work search requirement since the beginning of the pandemic, but this requirement will be reinstated on September 8th, according to the agency. Total jobless numbers do not reflect those who have stopped looking for work or who, for some reason, have cycled out of the system. Ernst has faith in Iowa absentee voting process. Although the Iowa GOP has voiced support for Republican National Committee lawsuits against three county auditors seeking to invalidate tens of thousands of voters' absentee ballot applications they sent to registered voters who have participated in recent elections, not all Republican officials are on board. Auditors in Lynn, Johnson, and Woodbury counties sent active registered voters absentee ballot request forms with their personal information already filled in. Voters just have to review, sign, and return the forms to get ballots in October that they can mail back or drop off, avoiding potential coronavirus-related health dangers at crowded polling places on Election Day, November 3rd. According to filings, the auditors, Joel Miller in Lynn County, Travis Weipert in Johnson County, and Pat Gill in Woodbury County, are among the officials willfully and unilaterally disobeying Iowa election law, RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel said. Their actions have destroyed a key mechanism designed to ensure the integrity of absentee voting. The Republican Party of Iowa is proud to stand with other Republican groups in joining this lawsuit to safeguard our absentee voting process and to protect common sense election laws, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman said. His counterpart at the Iowa Democratic Party accused Republicans of trying to rip away vote-by-mail efforts during a global pandemic. Republicans and Donald Trump are trying to suppress voters because they are terrified of being held accountable at the ballot box, Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Mark Smith said. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican, said election integrity is important to her, so having someone other than the voter put personal information on the absentee ballot request form makes me a little nervous, she said while in Cedar Rapids earlier this week. However, Ernst, a former Montgomery County auditor, called Iowa's absentee ballot system very strong. I do have faith in our county auditors, and I know so many of our county auditors, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and I think it's great that we have a decentralized way of doing our elections, still monitored by the Iowa State Code and our Secretary of State, Ernst said. We have some really phenomenal auditors across the state that are going to make sure that our elections are safe. When people ask me all across the state, I always say, I don't worry about Iowa. Hearings have been scheduled in Lynn County District Court on August 27th, in Woodbury County on August 28th, and Johnson County on September 9th. LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, has joined the auditors in opposing the RNC lawsuits. Miller, a Democrat, said he acted within his authority by mailing pre-populated forms to 140,000 registered voters last month. Many of those forms have been returned, and his office has been notifying voters their absentee ballots will be mailed October 5th. Weipert's office is sending the forms to 92,000 registered voters and has received thousands of responses. Johnson County long has been Iowa's most Democratic stronghold. Lynn County, the state's second largest, has been an important source of Democratic votes in recent elections. In 2016, Trump handily won Iowa by nearly 10 percentage points. He carried Woodbury 57% to 37%. He lost Lynn to Hillary Clinton 50% to 41% and Johnson 65% to 27%. Iowa Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate last month told auditors in an emergency election directive that the forms mailed to voters must be blank to ensure uniformity. His office has not taken any action to block the county mailings. Virus review. Rise in jobless claims reflects still struggling economy. GOP senator tests positive. The coronavirus recession struck swiftly and violently. Now, with the U.S. economy still in the grip of the outbreak 5 months later, the recovery looks fitful and uneven and painfully slow. The latest evidence came Thursday when the government reported that the number of workers applying for unemployment climbed back over 1 million last week after 2 weeks of declines. The figures suggest that employers are still slashing jobs, even as some businesses reopen and some sectors like housing and manufacturing have rebounded. Getting the virus in check dictates when there'll be relief from this economic nightmare, and it doesn't look like it will be soon, said Anne Elizabeth Conkle, an economist at Indeed, a job listing website. The scourge in the U.S. has killed more than 170,000 people and caused over 5.5 million confirmed infections, with deaths rising by more than 1,000 a day on average. Worldwide, the death toll stands at about 790,000, with over 22 million cases. The overall number of laid-off American workers collecting unemployment benefits declined last week from 15.5 million to 14.8 million. Many of them probably found jobs, but some may have used up all their benefits, which in most states run out after about 6 months. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy announced Thursday that he has tested positive for the coronavirus and is experiencing some COVID-19 symptoms. He said he is quarantining in Louisiana. The Republican senator, 62, who is running for re-election on November 3rd, is experiencing mild symptoms that began this morning from COVID-19, the illness caused by the virus, his spokesperson Cole Avery said. Cassidy, a physician from Baton Rouge who regularly wears a mask when in public, said in a statement that he was tested after being notified Wednesday night that he'd been exposed to someone infected with the virus. The senator said he is adhering to medical guidance and notifying people with whom he may have come into contact. In other developments, 1 in 5 U.S. nursing homes face severe shortages of protective gear like N95 masks this summer, even as the Trump administration pledged to help, according to a study released Thursday that finds facilities in areas hard hit by COVID-19 also struggle to keep staff. Airlines are requiring passengers to wear masks, but recent incidents involving young children have put the carriers on the spot for how they enforce rules on face coverings. U.S. Postal Service warnings that it can't guarantee mailed ballots will arrive on time have put a spotlight on the narrow time frames most states allow to request and return those ballots. As hospitals care for people with COVID-19 and try to prevent its spread, more patients are opting to be treated where they feel safest, at home. Iowa's medical director said that she was aware of inaccuracies in the state's coronavirus data when her agency used it to release flawed calculations that helped guide decisions on school openings and enrollment this month. New guidance from the Trump administration that declares teachers to be critical infrastructure workers could give the green light to exempting teachers from quarantine requirements after being exposed to COVID-19 and instead send them back into the classroom. A balky online connection is among the pitfalls that may face next month's Primetime Emmy Awards, forced into socially distanced safety by the coronavirus pandemic. The Distilled Spirits Council of the United States found that nationally, craft distillers will see an estimated 41% of their sales, worth more than $700 million, evaporate because of the pandemic. Roger Penske sent an open letter to Indianapolis 500 fans expressing his remorse for not opening the gates for Sunday's race. FEMA aid approved for Iowa County hardest hit by storm. President Donald Trump approved Federal Emergency Management Agency funding for eastern Iowa's Linn County, which was the county that was hardest hit by last week's rare hurricane-strength windstorm. Governor Kim Reynolds' office announced the approval Thursday night. The FEMA Individual Assistance Program helps homeowners, renters, and businesses affected by natural disasters. It includes assistance with housing, personal property replacement, medical expenses, and legal services. The approval was welcomed Friday in the county's largest city, Cedar Rapids, which suffered widespread damage from the August 10th storm that saw winds of up to 140 miles per hour. This will provide much-needed support to a number of critical needs in our community, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said at a news conference. Nearly 8,000 homes and businesses in the Cedar Rapids area remained without power Friday afternoon, some 11 days after the storm, an Alliant Energy official said. For those of you still without power, we are doing all we can do quickly and safely, Alliant Energy Vice President Joel Schmidt said. He said crews were bringing in smaller equipment as their work shifted to backyards and individual homes. with high temperatures expected over the weekend, the city announced Friday that it would open the U.S. Cellular Center on Saturday and Sunday as a cooling station for those who may lack air conditioning. Earlier this week, during a brief stop in Cedar Rapids, Trump promised to approve Reynolds' request for $180 million in FEMA aid for damaged homes and infrastructure for 27 counties in the state. He also promised additional funding for farmers who were affected by the storm. The FEMA request includes $100 million in damage to private utilities and $82.7 million in damage to homes, according to early state estimates. In addition, farmers sustained an estimated $2.7 billion in damage to crops, grain storage, and buildings, which is part of the declaration and would likely be covered under various U.S. Department of Agriculture programs. The FEMA requests for the 26 other Iowa counties are still being assessed. Iowa orders largest district to reopen schools despite COVID. Iowa's largest school district cannot begin the year with fully remote learning and must offer at least 50% in-person instruction despite a worsening coronavirus pandemic, the state said Friday. Des Moines Public Schools, which has 32,000 students and 5,000 employees, blasted the decision by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' administration to deny its request for a waiver to allow for 100% online learning. The district announced that it would file a lawsuit to challenge the state's order to reopen schools, a prospect that it said was simply unsafe because of the coronavirus threat. Unfortunately, the governor and her agencies have decided to ignore the local decision-making authority set out in the law to try and force their will on school districts to do things we all know are simply not safe at this time, said Kirsten Delagardelle, the chair of the school board. Superintendent Thomas A. Hart said the district's virtual learning plan was not an act of political defiance, but rather a science-based approach to resuming instruction during a pandemic. The district said that it would continue planning for a virtual start to the school year next month and allow sports and activities to continue with safety precautions. The Iowa Department of Education denied the district's waiver request on Thursday. The agency said the denial would still allow parents to choose 100% virtual learning for students, and the district could offer a hybrid approach in which students get 50% in-person learning and the rest online. The governor is disappointed that the district plans to sue rather than to work cooperatively to develop a return-to-learn plan that complies with the law and meets the educational and health needs of Iowa's children, said her spokesman, Pat Garrett. Reynolds has said that school districts must provide at least 50% in-person instruction, or administrators, educators, and students will face consequences, including being forced to make up extra hours of instructional time later. She said schools can seek a waiver to move to remote learning for 2 weeks at a time if the county 14-day positivity rate hits 15%, a threshold three times higher than what is recommended by many public health experts. The Department of Education told the Des Moines District in its waiver denial that Polk County's 8% positivity rate was below the governor's threshold and that the district failed to identify any other basis for moving to remote-only learning. The counties of Plymouth and Henry were the only out of Iowa's 99 counties that were above the 15% threshold as of Friday afternoon. Doe said the Department of Education has not granted any waivers for districts to begin online. Dozens of other Iowa counties are currently above the 5% positivity rate that the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggest may be safe for reopening schools. The lawsuit from the Des Moines District will be the second case that will argue the governor is overstepping her authority, creating more uncertainty for tens of thousands of students, parents, and educators. The Iowa State Education Association and the Iowa City Community School District filed a lawsuit Wednesday seeking to block enforcement of the governor's mandate. A September 3rd hearing has been scheduled on their request for a temporary injunction. If granted, it would mean school districts would have their own authority to decide whether to move to 100% remote learning and not face retaliation from the state if they do. Reynolds said Thursday that the majority of school districts will begin in-person instruction by next week. Many others have delayed their start dates until September, either because of the coronavirus or the derecho storm that damaged many schools last week. The union and the district argue that the governor is misinterpreting state law and that local school boards have broad powers to make their own decisions about when in-person learning will be safe. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, August 21st, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Hazel Scatter, 1925 to 2020. Hazel Scatter, 95, of Lake Mills, died Tuesday, August 18th, at the Lake Mills Care Center. A private funeral service for Hazel will be held at 2 p.m., Friday, August 21st, with Pastor Melinda McCluskey officiating. Only immediate family will be able to attend the service. For those who cannot attend, the service will be streamed live on the Middlestadt Funeral Home Facebook page beginning at 2 p.m. Friday. Burial will take place at Salem Memorial Cemetery in Lake Mills. Hazel Scatter was born on August 16, 1925, in Worth County, Silver Lake Township, the daughter of Henry Norris and Gunvor Sorbo Oyer. She was baptized and confirmed at Silver Lake Lutheran Church in rural Northwood. Hazel attended school in rural Worth County and later graduated from Emmons High School in Emmons, Minnesota in 1942. On September 21, 1947, she was united in marriage to Obert George Scatter at the Silver Lake Church Parsonage in rural Northwood. To this union, three children were born, Manfred, Barbara, and Lauren. She was a devoted farmer's wife for 18 years in the Lake Mills area. Hazel worked as a data entry typist at Wilson's Packing Plant in Albert Lea, Minnesota. She had also worked at the Lake Mills School Kitchen as a cook and head baker for 27 years before retiring in 1992. Her love for the Lord, family, and friends were very important to Hazel. She particularly loved it when her grandchildren and great-grandchildren would come to her home. She was even-tempered, very generous, and extremely tech-savvy with social media, and enjoyed communicating with everyone with email, instant messaging, and Facebook. She was a member of Ladies' Aid and Circle at North Prairie Lutheran and Salem Lutheran Churches. She enjoyed taking bus trips, reading, playing cards, bunco, and watching the Minnesota Twins. In her later years, she was an avid supporter of the Lake Mills Senior Center and was an officer on the board and delivered Meals on Wheels. Hazel is survived by her children, Manfred Scatter and spouse Kathy of Joyce, Barbara Vaughn and spouse Raymond of Gilbert, Arizona, Lauren Scatter and spouse Sandy of Lake Mills, grandchildren Kelly Estes and spouse Jeff of Georgetown, Texas, Jessica Smith and spouse Brian of Levine, Arizona, Tracy Strathman and spouse Michael of Randolph, Nebraska, John Scatter and spouse Amanda of Windsor Heights, Pamela Westman and spouse Jason of Mankato, Minnesota, and Daniel Scatter of West Des Moines. Six great-grandchildren, along with numerous extended relatives and friends. She is preceded in death by her only sibling, Forrest Oyer, her parents, her husband, Obert, his parents, son-in-law, Ronald Thompson, and great-grandson, Anthony Strathman. You can contact the family with online condolences at MiddlestadtFuneralHome.com, and Middlestadt is spelled MiddleStadt. Shelley J. Earhart Gambrell. Shelley Joanne Earhart Gambrell, 56, of Clarion, passed away on Wednesday, August 19th, in Clarion. Services are pending with Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. Georgia M. Jacobson. A celebration of life visitation for Georgia May Jacobson, 91, of Rake, where the family will greet friends, will be held Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Zion Lutheran Church in Rake. Social distancing practices will be followed, and the family requests that attendees please wear masks. Georgia died Saturday, June 6th, at the Lake Mills Care Center at the age of 91. Oak Crest Funeral Services of Buffalo Center is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences may be made at oakcrestfuneralservices.com. Carlene Granskow Grandin, 1933 to 2020. Carlene M. Grandin left this earth, as she did most occasions, with grace and an indelible impression on the many who knew and met her. She passed quietly on August 17th in her Methwick community at age 87. She remains in our memories as a grand person, a woman of substance who will be dearly missed. Carlene began her life in the small town of Joyce, followed by college and love in Iowa City, and ending in the city she loved, Cedar Rapids. Throughout her life, she cherished the company of friends and family and all the conversation, food, laughter, and occasional chaos that went with it. She loved a good argument and excelled in witty repartee. Carlene's unique charisma, equal parts Iowa sensibility and cosmopolitan style, set her apart. She was rarefied with a genuine interest in people and pets and the lives they led. Carlene had a lifetime love of literature. She read everything. Sitting on a beach with toes in the sand and a good read was a perfect day. She never stopped learning and shared her knowledge as an instructor of nursing and literature. She enjoyed music, especially through opera, the piano, and singing with choirs and her family in her baritone voice. She masterminded a myriad of social events just for the joy of bringing others together. To all who knew her, Carlene is remembered as a philanthropist and patron. She put desire into action through the Carlene and Eugene Grandin Charitable Foundation and support for the Cedar Rapids Opera and Theater Cedar Rapids. She was a longtime member of the Cedar Rapids Country Club and former board member of the Hall Foundation. Carlene is fondly remembered by four generations: Sister Ellen Lou Anderson of Clear Lake, nieces Lori Brew of Joyce and her husband Gary, Rachel Anderson of Clear Lake, Roberta Howie of Garner, and Jennifer Tatum of Mason City. Grand nieces and nephews, Carly Brew of Portland, Oregon, Peter Brew of St. Louis, Missouri, Aaron Sorensen of Northbrook, Illinois, Isaac Sorensen of Lakeville, Minnesota, Jake Sorensen of Clear Lake, Amanda Burton of Perth, Australia, Alex Howie of Minneapolis, Minnesota, Zach Tatum of Omaha, Nebraska, and Cole Tatum of Mason City, and numerous great-grandnieces and nephews, including extended family members. She is preceded in death by her husband, Dr. Eugene Grandin, father, Carl Granskow, mother, Mandy, and brother, Lane, and special friend, the Honorable Edward Nick McManus. A private service will be held at Christ Episcopal Church Columbarium. Carlene wishes that any memorial be a donation to your favorite charity. The family wishes that you raise a toast to Carlene at your next gathering. IHSAA, no sports for schools that opt for online-only school. In a joint letter sent to athletic directors around the state, Tom Keating and Gene Berger, the executive directors of the IHSAA and IGHSAU, said that any schools that opt for online-only learning this fall due to concerns over COVID-19 may not have in-person contact for sports. We believe the decision to conduct in-person athletic activities should not be made independently of the decision to conduct in-person academic learning, the letter read in part. Member schools who choose to return to school at 100% virtual learning or suspend in-person learning at some point in the future due to concerns over health and safety of their community may continue virtual-only learning for their athletic programs. As we determined last spring, when a school reverts to 100% online learning or must shut down in-person learning due to the activity of the virus in their community, no in-person contact for sports may occur. The decision impacts Des Moines Public Schools, which has asked the Iowa Department of Education for a waiver to begin the school year fully online. As of now, no area schools have decided to hold schools in an online-only fashion. Top of Iowa schools release fall sports COVID-19 guidelines. The fall sports season is underway, and with COVID-19 continuing to spread across the country, many school districts in Iowa are taking precautions to help prevent the virus's spread. Earlier this week, the Top of Iowa Conference sent out a list of the precautions being taken by its member schools. Some Top of Iowa schools require spectators to wear face masks, but others have chosen not to do so. Instead, the schools highly encourage spectators to mask up and follow the social distancing guidelines of remaining 6 feet away from other people, as recommended by the Center for Disease Control. West Hancock released its guidelines and expectations earlier this week. This year, masks are highly recommended, but not required at Eagles athletic events. Spectators are expected to social distance, and if they cannot maintain that distance, masks should be worn. For indoor events, such as volleyball games, no spectators will be allowed to sit in the first two rows of the bleachers, and any ball touched by fans will be taken out of play. Student sections are also asked to social distance and gather in groups of 10 people or less. Masks within the pods are also strongly encouraged to be worn. Attendance of fans is not limited, but bleachers will be marked to tell fans where to sit for social distancing purposes. Hand sanitizing stations will be located at the entrance to all athletic events at West Hancock, and fans are asked to not attend if they feel ill or exhibit any signs of COVID-19. School events play a huge role in the lives of our students, West Hancock Activities Director Steve Lansing said in a statement sent out by the school. If everyone does their part to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19, we hope we have a successful fall sports season. Please note that these guidelines are subject to change and will be updated when necessary. Other schools in the top of Iowa Conference are requiring the use of masks to attend games this year, and all of the member schools recommend that fans social distance. The CDC recommends the use of face masks in public settings to help slow the spread of COVID-19. Bishop Garrigan, masks required for volleyball, not football. Eagle Grove, masks not required, but highly recommended for all paying spectators. Forest City, masks not required, but highly recommended for all non-competing members. Garner Hayfield Ventura, masks not required, but highly recommended for all non-competing members. Lake Mills, masks required for all visitors. North Iowa, masks not required, but encouraged. North Union, masks not required, but highly recommended. West Hancock, masks not required, but highly recommended. Central Springs, masks encouraged. Nashua Plainfield, masks highly recommended. Newman Catholic, masks required. North Butler, masks required. Northwood Kensett, masks required for all non-competing attendees. Osage, masks required. Rockford, masks required if people cannot social distance. St. Ansgar, masks required. West Fork, masks required. Nyack basketball team set to start season in January. After COVID-19 wreaked havoc in the world of college sports, the Nyack sports programs were thrown into uncertainty. But finally, JUCO sports fans have something to look forward to. This year's NJCAA basketball season has been moved to spring semester, and this week, the Nyack men's and women's programs both announced their 2021 schedules. The season for both teams will begin in mid-January, with the men's team opening its 22-game all-ICCAC schedule on January 20th with a game at Iowa Central. The Trojans have advanced to the NJCAA Region 11 title game each of the past 2 years. The Nyack women will open their first season under new head coach Brad Vaught on January 20th at Iowa Central. The Trojans, who have won each of the past two NJCAA Region 11 championships, will play a 20-game all-conference schedule. Both teams' home openers will come on January 23rd against DMAC. A letter to the editor. More derecho coverage needed. Why has there been so little media coverage by local newspapers and TV in regards to the devastating derecho storm that ravaged the middle of Iowa from west to east on Monday, August 10th? A couple of articles in the Globe, nothing front page as it should have been. KIMT-TV coverage was pathetic. Just a small mention of the storm on the 10 p.m. news on Monday, and no on-site coverage to show anything since then besides flattened cornfields. Many of us in this news underserved north central part of Iowa have relatives and friends in the affected areas who are suffering and in need of assistance to deal with this latest disaster. How have we become so detached from the rest of our Iowa neighbors? Are we relying too much on social media to spread the news? There is a segment of our population who are still dependent on and rely on coverage by our local news media. We need to and deserve to be better served. Signed, Michelle Larson, Mason City. A letter to the editor. Mason City lucky to have variety of news outlets. Recently, a letter was published bemoaning the move of KIMT to Minnesota. Mason City has been lucky to have been served by KIMT, the Globe Gazette, and several radio stations. KIMT continues to have reporters in the city. Amy Fleming, news anchor here or in Rochester, continues to be a home face. Our children grew up watching Bart's Clubhouse. We too are saddened by the move of the home base, but are aware of the consolidation of news outlets and are thankful to have the Globe, KIMT CBS service, and several radio stations to choose from. Lucky us. Signed, John Rinkman, Mason City. Iowa coronavirus cases up 823 as state demands schools open. Iowa on Friday reported more than 800 new coronavirus cases, an indication the virus continues to spread as the state pushes forward with the demand that local school districts resume in-person classes. The Iowa Department of Public Health daily count shows 54,653 positive cases, an increase of 823 in the past 24 hours. Five additional deaths bring the state total to 1,017. Many school districts begin classes next week, although some have delayed the start to later this month or early September. The requirement that districts begin schools with children in classrooms has prompted the State Teachers Union and Iowa City School District officials to sue Governor Kim Reynolds and the state's top education official to block enforcement of the return-to-school mandate. A hearing is scheduled for September 3rd. Reynolds acknowledged Thursday the virus was spreading, hospitalizations are increasing, and nursing home outbreaks are on the rise. Reynolds has said that schools with a 15% positivity rate can seek a waiver to start the year online. Otherwise, districts must offer at least 50% in-person instruction. Parents also may choose individually to enroll their children in online-only options. The World Health Organization recommends a 5% positivity rate or lower threshold for relaxation of mitigation efforts to slow the virus. State records show that districts in 69 Iowa counties are above that level. Clear Lake City Council okays new ambulance. Purchase will replace 2013 model damaged in a mid-June crash. It will likely be 4 months before the Clear Lake Fire Department has all three of its ambulances back in service. The Clear Lake City Council approved the purchase of a 2020 F450 cab and chassis, including the remount of the 2013 Lifeline box and a new cot, for $53,781 Monday evening during its meeting. The 2020 F450 cab and chassis will replace the fire department's oldest ambulance, a 2013 F450 that was damaged in mid-June in a collision during the transport of a patient to Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. The damage, estimated at $51,582, was enough that City Administrator Scott Florey and Fire Chief Doug Myers recommended the city replace it with proceeds from its insurance claim. The city is anticipating about $43,000 in insurance proceeds for the salvaged cab and chassis and about $19,000 for the cot from the Iowa Communities Assurance Pool, or ICAP, a member-owned and operated self-insurance entity for public entities in Iowa. Myers said the existing box sustained very little damage in the collision and can be remounted on the new chassis. Most of the damage was in the cab and the chassis component, he said. According to the city's insurance claim, the most costly damages were done to the right side fender, frame, window, and outer mirror of the cab and chassis. The new cab and chassis is estimated to cost about $51,000 after the city's deductible. The cot that was in the ambulance at the time of the crash can't be recertified for use, so it also must also be replaced, Flory said. The city budgeted for the replacement of two cots, including the one involved in the crash, in fiscal year 2021, Flory said. He said the city won't have to dip too deeply into its ambulance reserve fund to put the 2020 chassis and cab in service because of the insurance proceeds and 2021 budget allocation. The ambulance, which had about 50,000 miles on it, was scheduled to be replaced in 7 years, Myers said. The other two ambulances the city owns are from 2018 and 2019. Flory said the two ambulances will provide adequate coverage in the interim until the third is back in rotation. Myers said the earliest the new cab and chassis with the remounted box and cot could be in service is November. He anticipates the cab and chassis will be delivered within the next month, but it'll likely take about a month to remount the box. The box is being remounted by Lifeline Emergency Vehicles, the original manufacturers of the ambulance, Myers said. Biden aiming for unity. XVP accepts party's nomination at final day of virtual event. Joe Biden vowed to unite an America torn by crisis and contempt Thursday night, accepting the Democratic presidential nomination and achieving a pinnacle in an unfinished quest that has spanned 3 decades and been marred by personal tragedy, political stumbles, and more dynamic rivals. The past hurdles fell away as Biden addressed his fellow Democrats and millions of Americans at home who he hopes will send him to the White House to replace Donald Trump. Though his triumphant moment was drained of immediate drama by the coronavirus pandemic, which left him speaking to a nearly empty arena rather than to a joyously cheering crowd. Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst, Biden declared. I'll be an ally of the light, not our darkness. Biden pointed to the public health emergency and the severe economic fallout to turn traits previously seen as vulnerabilities, notably a long career spent in elected office, into an advantage by presenting himself as a competent leader in a moment that Democrats say cries out for one in the White House. The night's keynote address was the speech of a lifetime for Biden, who at 77 would be the oldest president ever elected if he defeats Trump in November. But his convention leaned on a younger generation earlier in the night to help energize his sprawling coalition. Tammy Duckworth, an Illinois senator who lost both legs in Iraq and is raising 2 young children, said Biden has common decency. Cory Booker, only the 9th African-American senator in U.S. history, said Biden believes in the dignity of all working Americans. And Pete Buttigieg, a 38-year-old openly gay military veteran from Indiana, noted that Biden came out in favor of same-sex marriage as vice president even before President Barack Obama did. Joe Biden is right. This is a contest for the soul of the nation. And to me, that contest is not between good Americans and evil Americans, Buttigieg said. It's the struggle to call out what is good for every American. Above all, Biden focused on uniting the nation as Americans grapple with the long and fearful health crisis, the related economic devastation, a national awakening on racial justice, and Trump, who stirs heated emotions from all sides. Throughout their convention, the Democrats have summoned a collective urgency about the dangers of Trump as president. Briefs. Trump taxes. As President Donald Trump's lawyers moved swiftly Thursday to appeal a federal judge's ruling that granted Manhattan's top prosecutor access to his tax returns, Trump blasted the long-running quest for his financial records as a continuation of the most disgusting witch hunt in the history of our country. Iraq withdrawal. President Donald Trump on Thursday reaffirmed his plan to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq as quickly as possible as he met with the Prime Minister of Iraq to discuss ways to rein in militias in the country and counter residual threats from Islamic State sleeper cells. Coma. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, one of Vladimir Putin's fiercest critics, lay in a coma Friday at a Siberian hospital, the victim of what his allies said appeared to be a poisoning engineered by the Kremlin. Twitter. President Donald Trump on Thursday asked the Supreme Court to allow him to block critics from his personal Twitter account. The federal appeals court in New York ruled last year that Trump uses his personal account to make pronouncements and observations that are overwhelmingly official in nature. It held that Trump violated the First Amendment whenever he blocked a critic. Fauci. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the U.S. government's top infectious disease expert, underwent outpatient surgery Thursday to remove a growth from his vocal cord that was causing his notably raspy voice. Wildfires. More than 24 major fires were scorching California on Thursday and taxing the state's firefighting capacity, sparked by an unprecedented lightning siege that dropped nearly 11,000 strikes over several days. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, August 21st, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.